The 1999 murder of Haman Lee in Baltimore, Maryland, and the prosecution and conviction of Adnan Syed and her murder has now been documented in multiple podcasts with dozens and dozens of episodes. It's been written about in hundreds of articles. It's been covered by every major news outlet and has launched a global movement for justice. And yet, there is much more to the story, including Adnan's own telling of it. St. Martin's Press brings you Adnan's Story, Murder, Justice, and the Case That Captivated a Nation, the first and seminal book about the case that I was honored to write with contributions from Adnan himself. The book releases September 6, 2016, but is already available for pre-order. Go to www.adnanstory.com to place your order and reserve your copy today.
Hi, this is Colin Miller with another special interview episode of Undisclosed. According to Gallup, Congress is the institution in which Americans expressed the least confidence in 2015, with only 8% doing so, a mere 1-point increase above its 7% rating in 2014, the lowest that Gallup has ever measured for any institution. Now, another institution that's held this dishonor in the past is the criminal justice system, which has ranked last 6 times since 1973. Additionally, a Pew Research Center study of 10,000 American adults finds the country more divided than ever, with both personal and political polarization at a 20-year high. In the political realm, Sarah Binder of the Brookings Institution has charted the rise of political gridlock over the decades, finding that it has doubled since 1950, with the legislative wheels even grinding to a halt during the federal government shutdown of 2013. These issues stem in large part from legislators increasingly failing to work across party lines. In the past 2 years, both Ross Baker and Laurel Harbridge have published books asking the same question: is bipartisanship dead? My guest today would answer that question in the negative and seek to return us to a time when compromise wasn't a dirty word. But first, a word from our sponsor. Not all ingredients are created equal. Fresh, high-quality ingredients taste better and are better for you, so it's important to know where your food comes from. Blue Apron knows that when you cook with incredible ingredients, you make incredible meals. So they set the highest quality standards for their community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, fisheries, and ranchers. Whether it's Japanese ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, Blue Apron is bringing you the best. For less than $10 per meal, Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. New recipes are created each week by Blue Apron's culinary team and are not repeated within a year. You can customize your recipes each week based upon your preferences, and you can choose delivery options to fit your needs. There is no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want them. Each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card and pre-portioned ingredients and can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. Check out this week's menu and get your 2 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/undisclosed. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. That's blueapron.com/undisclosed. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Today's episode is Bipartisan Justice. I'll be speaking with the chairs of the South Carolina Democratic and Republican parties about working across party lines to try to achieve progress in criminal justice and other realms. Jamie Harrison is the chair of the South Carolina Democratic Party. He's also the co-author of the forthcoming book, Climbing the Hill, about how to go about starting a career in politics. He's also the host of the series Chair Chats, where he interviews prominent Democrats such as Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. Chair Chats is available on YouTube. It's also available on podcast form audioboom.com/channel/chairchats. Matt Moore is the chair of the South Carolina Republican Party. From 2013 to 2015, he was actually the youngest state chairman in America's 2 major political parties. He's also been mentioned as a possible contender for the Republican National Committee chairman in 2017. So Jamie and Matt, thanks so much for joining me today and welcome to the Undisclosed Podcast.
Thanks, Colin.
Good to be here.
Now, earlier this year, CNN did a story on you two, and they labeled you two South Carolina's political odd couple based upon your willingness to work across party lines together. But Jamie, you noted in the piece that it's not that strange because the two of you had similar personal stories, and it was rising up to take part in the American dream that links you two together. So could you tell me a bit about your upbringing and what led you to a career in politics?
Yeah. Again, thank you so much for having us, Colin. It's always a pleasure being with my friend Matt Moore. You know, we both have very working class backgrounds. For me, I grew up in a household with a single mother who was supported by her parents. My mom was very young when she had me. She was actually a teenager. And so she had to drop out of school in order to take care of me. But she and my grandparents focused a lot of their energy and efforts, despite not having a whole lot of education themselves, into making sure that I had the best education possible. So, I was the first in my family to go to college. I left South Carolina and went to Yale University and then attended Georgetown University for law school. But all the while, despite getting a great education, I always had an appreciation for what the working poor and the working class folks in America have to go through and the barriers that they have to overcome. And understanding those challenges has been part of my perspective and part of why I got involved in politics.
Yeah, and Matt, how about you? I know you grew up in Georgia before coming over to South Carolina. What was your upbringing like?
My story is very similar, Colin. Thanks for having me. I was born in what could, I think, charitably be described as a mobile home park in South Georgia. Nothing wrong with that. Those places, my parents wanted more for us. My mom and dad, neither of them attended college. By the time I was born, my mom was 19. My dad was in his mid-20s. I remember going to college classes with my mom as a child, spending many nights in libraries. My mom was the first person in her family to actually finish college and then went on to get her master's degree and a specialist degree in education. She instilled in us a spirit that it's not if you'll go to college, it's when you'll go to college. And it's a classic American dream of leaving your children better off than yourself. So for that, I'm very thankful. And I am very much aware, as Jamie, I think, maybe not in the exact same ways, but the struggles that families go through in America to make ends meet, to pay for college, to buy groceries, the seemingly simple things in life that are often difficult. And I think both of our parties are committed to solving those challenges, maybe in different ways. But, you know, the Democrats, in my mind, are not the enemy. The enemy is always the status quo. And that's why I like Jamie so much. He is committed to improving the status quo and changing the status quo.
Yeah, and Matt, if I looked at that piece from CNN too, another thing that links the two of you is, as you say, many people from the outside can't understand what it's like to be a party chair. And so what was it that led you to being the youngest party chair in the nation back in 2013? And what are some of the duties and responsibilities of being a state party chair?
Well, I have always wanted to serve. I think Americans have this really unique spirit of service, public service. I remember being a child, revering elected officials, even at that point as a child, county councilmen and mayors, thinking it was quite cool. I wonder how they get elected. And always, was interested in politics. I wasn't formally involved in politics until after college when I interned for the governor's office in Georgia. I was actually a software engineer for the campaign. I came along, thankfully, at a very good time in politics for my career. It was the first really election cycle that technology was used in a big way. President Obama's campaign, of course, pioneered many of the things that the Republican Party is doing now. That led me to being chairman. I take my role very seriously. Part of being chairman is not only what you say, but what you don't say. And so we're very careful to be constructive and forward-looking, and to not try to pick fights at every turn, but to pick our battles and try to improve not only the political system, but also the dialogue in the country.
Okay, and Jamie, after going to Yale and Georgetown Law School, you decided to return to South Carolina and become the first African-American chair of the South Carolina Democratic Party. What was it that led you into wanting to become the South Carolina Democratic chair?
Yeah, so I spent a good deal of time between college and after college, working on Capitol Hill, where I worked for Congressman Jim Clyburn. And, you know, in South Carolina, even though I wasn't here physically, it was always in my heart. And I saw where we were as a party in South Carolina, and the fact that most of my family still lived here, felt that there were some things that I could do in order to improve their lives. And, you know, the thought is, well, you can go home and you can run for office, or you can go and make the party that you belong to better. And so that's when my wife and I decided to leave Washington, D.C., and come back to South Carolina, and I decided to run for the chairmanship of the party with a goal of rebuilding the party here in South Carolina. We, the Republicans, when I was growing up, were wandering in the wilderness here in South Carolina. They were out of the majority, but they took the majority, and so now the Democrats have found themselves wandering in the wilderness, needing to refresh itself, rebuild the infrastructure of the party, come up with a more energizing and invigorating message. And so that's what I've been spending my time and effort as chair working on.
Yeah, and I've seen on social media you've noted several times and had people comment about the importance of civility in modern politics, and you've noted how you and Matt are trying to serve as models in that regard. Why do you think that civility is so important, and why do you think it's to a large extent been lost in the modern political landscape?
I learned politics really from working in the office of Jim Clyburn. And I remember when I first got on to Capitol Hill, one of the things he told me was that there was an unspoken rule with the South Carolina delegation when he first got to Washington, D.C., that when they came to Washington, D.C., that they would focus on working to do what was in the best interest of South Carolina. And sometimes that meant putting aside their political hats of Democrat or Republican. And I took that to heart. And as the way and the method in order to get things done and in order to get things to move forward. And if you've studied our, particularly how Washington, D.C. works, you'll understand that you have to have compromise. You have to have good relations with the other side of the aisle in order to move things and get things done. Otherwise, you have the gridlock that we are seeing so much in Washington, D.C. now. And as a result, all of the people suffer. And my thing is, I'm always a supporter of a positive movement, positive action, moving forward. Not to say that I will get everything that I want all the time, but if most of the people can get some things to move the country forward, I think that's a very positive thing, and that's where I want to be.
Yeah, Matt, in that regard, I know there was a town hall earlier this year by Wake the Vote, and you were quoted as saying, there are no bad people in politics, just bad ideas. And I think that also speaks to the idea of, again, something that's lost often in the political debate, and that is it's about working with people, and you might disagree on the ideas, but it's so important to work together and trying to find these common goals and solutions, right?
That's right. I think the unfortunate thing about politics now is it's almost become, like everything else in our culture, about the team sport of it, that we're so polarized because a group of Americans has chosen the Warriors and another group has chosen the Cavaliers. And at times, that doesn't seem to be the best way to do things. And the sort of commonality of our principles is lost. And that's why Jamie and I, when we've been able, have tried to find common ground on specific policy ideas or proposals, or just being nice people to each other to try to set a good example and doing those things.
Yeah, and in terms of setting that example, last fall, I know the two of you, along with Don Fowler, co-taught a class at the University of South Carolina on politics. And can you tell me a bit about that experience? What led you to teach the class and how you found working with the next generation of voters as they were exposed to the political system?
I have a newfound appreciation for college professors. It is quite difficult to get ready to teach a class for an hour and a half once a week. And some professors do it more than once. That includes reviewing notes and studying and being sure you're factually accurate, because students are more than happy to point out where you're not correct, which makes it very fun, obviously. But teaching with Jamie was fascinating because I think most of the students were surprised to even see Democrats and Republicans communicating, much less enjoying
an easy rapport and actually agreeing on some fairly key issues. And to me, that's a good example to set for students beyond all of the policy things we discussed and the history we discussed. That's a good thing. And I think what they further saw is that the battles we face right now as parties and as a country are not new. The story of America is a story of sort of constant challenges and stresses and at times wars to figure it all out. And that's the great American experiment. And so we tried to frame a lot of the issues we discussed in that way.
You know, it was a great experience. I loved teaching with Matt and with Don Fowler. I learned something new every class. And I agree with Matt. I think the thing that I got out of the class is our purpose and we have a common goal, which is how do we improve South Carolina, how we improve this nation. We are on different paths to get to that goal, but nonetheless, the goal is all the same. And so it was always great to get Matt's perspective and get his ideas and to learn more from him about the Republican Party and how it operates.
Yeah, and in addition to teaching the class together, I've seen that you two have published a couple of pieces together, one a few years ago about electing the military leader of the state of South Carolina, and then earlier this year in the Post and Courier, the Charleston newspaper, you two published a piece together that talked about global engagement and the need for both the Republican and the Democratic candidate to address global engagement and have a plan. And so how have you two found writing together and working together on these various projects?
Well, to Jamie's credit, when I call him, he's always happy to listen. He doesn't always say yes, and that's okay, but he's always happy to listen. And so that characterizes our relationship. On this issue, particularly global engagement, it's an issue that's very near and dear to my own heart. I've been in the past couple of years to Africa, to China, to the Middle East, and I actually have seen what happens or what does not happen when America does not choose to engage globally. And there's a misconception that our global engagement is mostly from the defense spectrum. It's involving ourselves in conflicts or in conflicts arise. That's simply not true. And it's much more than that. It's diplomacy, it's development, it's helping train African farmers. It's negotiating peace in stressed and war-torn regions, and that we should not abandon that traditional post-World War II American vision of engagement in the world. And so we thought it was important to raise the issue in our primary here in South Carolina and have it up for discussion. I think it was very helpful.
Yeah, and Jamie, another of the projects you two have worked on together, this is actually the subject of the CNN piece, that back in January, the two of you visited a prison in South Carolina, and you met with the prisoners, you talked with the agency director, Brian Sterling, about safety, security, and rehabilitation. So can you tell me a bit about your visit to the prison and your conversation with the prisoners in Sterling and what effect that had on you?
Yeah, you know, I still think about that trip quite often, Colin. It really was an eye-opening experience, a life-changing experience, and I was glad to be able to do it and talk with Matt as we went through this prison here in South Carolina. The United States has 5% of the world's population, but yet 25% of those in prison in the world are here in the United States. It's a staggering statistic. And what's even worse is the disproportionate number of African-American men that are in prison, particularly for, you know, nonviolent offenses, many times dealing with issues surrounding drugs. And so it's something that's near and dear to my heart. And it was, again, just such an eye-opening experience to actually go in there and talk with the prisoners, to see what the state's doing. And I really applaud them in some of the efforts that they're doing in order to make the lives of those prisoners better, to make sure that they're getting educated, to make sure they are getting the skills so that once they have served their time, they can come back and integrate back into our society. And so I hope this is a space where there seem to be some agreement with Democrats and Republicans how we can move forward and how we reform our system so that, you know, we're imprisoning less folks when it relates to nonviolent issues, and then really focusing on the rehabilitation and providing the treatment needed to address some of the issues that many times are you know, related to mental problems and just the problems of impoverished communities. So I hope that we can find some common ground. There's some synergy in D.C. right now But it really was an amazing experience, and I was pleased to be able to do it with Matt.
Yeah, and Matt, I'm looking at your quotes from the CNN piece. I'm quoting from the article. According to you, I think criminal justice reform and sentencing reform are the defining civil rights struggle of the 21st century. It's not a Republican or Democrat issue. It's a policy issue. It's an American issue. So could you speak a bit about your experience visiting the prison and the meaning of that quote about this being the predominant civil rights struggle of the 21st century?
Visiting the prison with Jamie was a life-changing experience. So the real question is, why do Republicans and Democrats agree on this issue, on the need for criminal justice reform? It's because on one side, it's those who believe, and I think it's true, that the carceral state is really, really expensive. And for many others, I think this is across the spectrum, it limits the country's potential. And there is more, I think, bipartisanship on criminal justice reform than almost any other issue. Republicans understand that we can't reduce the prison population without also strengthening alternatives like probation and drug courts. And if a person is already in prison, we need to have workforce training and drug treatment options there within the prison. And recently, a U.S. senator said that we actually have an under-incarceration problem, meaning that we need more people in jail. I disagree with that wholeheartedly. We need less people committing crimes, and so how do we do that? And I think that's another question. So it's community policing. You know, this includes things like making sure police forces look more like the communities they're serving, as well as body cameras. You know, South Carolina has been a leader on body cameras after the tragic shooting in Charleston of an unarmed African-American man by a white officer. We have to balance law and liberty. What I mean by that is nonviolent offenders really at some point have no business being in jail. And you hear about things like a person who stole a pair of socks and it was his third offense and is now in prison for 30 years. And that is continually, I think, increasingly becoming more understood to not be a system that works. We should be treating drug issues and punishing drug dealers, not users. Europe does a great job of this. And actually, Texas, of all states, Jamie's going to probably laugh because it's a bastion of Republicanism, but Texas has led this charge on a lot of these things, and they've reduced the prison population in Texas by 14%, and actually crime has gone down by about 30% in Texas. And I think finally is the most important thing is that idle hands lead to idle minds, and the lack of opportunity, particularly in African-American communities across the country, presents huge challenges. And you combine that with recidivism rates being very high across the country, and people who actually go to prison are very likely to return. And so I think that's why there's a huge agreement on this issue. It's that it's an issue, when I say it's a defining civil rights issue of the 21st century, is that it touches on a lot of the social unease of the country about policing, about police cameras, about racial issues. And if you get to the heart of it, criminal justice reform has a lot to do with a lot of these issues.
And last month, I noted that South Carolina unanimously passed a bipartisan bill. This was a bill that raised the age at which juveniles can be tried as adults from 17 to 18. And the articles on it noted this was bipartisan support. It was unanimously passed. What was the thinking by both of the parties in that regard in terms of raising that age for juvenile offenders?
Well, I think certainly violent offenses fall under a different category, and certainly violent offenses should be dealt with in the appropriate way. But I think the intent here is to give second chances. And if a person is sufficiently rehabilitated from mental illness or from drug problems or from a variety of different things, then they deserve that second chance. And I think that's really the core of it here, is that we're trying to be a state that, again, balances law and liberty to give people opportunity when it's merited and to reduce the huge strain and expense on the system. And in fact, here in South Carolina, it costs about as much to send a person to prison for a year as it does to send a student to college. And that's something I always think about.
Yeah, and Jamie, I know that you spent those years in Orangeburg, your hometown, teaching, and I know that you look at this great link between education or lack thereof and the criminal justice system. And what do you think can be done in the education system to have an impact on the criminal justice system?
Yeah, you know, there's so much, Colin. And partly, you know, there's some cultural things and barriers that we have to get over with. I remember growing up and some of my family had just a natural distrust for the police, and it's because of the relationships that existed between the communities that we grew up in, and things that the police have done before to many of the young men. And so it was this natural distrust. And I remember going to college and talking about that, and I think a lot of that came out in the O.J. Simpson trial, and people were wondering about, well, why so many African Americans were siding on one side and so many white Americans were on another side. And a part of it was this sort of a natural sense of, well, I'm sure they planted this, or the police did that, or the police did that. And it was partly based on experiences in the past. And so one of the things that I think is going to be fundamental in terms of any true criminal justice reform is building and strengthening the bonds of trust between the communities and the police that serve those communities. And I think that is a fundamental issue that needs to happen. I think education is at the core, because for young folks like me who grew up and don't have much money, you know, education is the path in order to get to prosperity. And, you know, if you can leave or improve these communities where there aren't a lot of opportunity and have this gateway for so many young folks, I think, you know, instead of, as my grandma always said, that idle minds is a devil workshop. So instead of being idle and you fill those minds with you know, books and jobs and all alike, then, you know, kids won't get in trouble and doing things that they probably shouldn't be doing. And so that's going to be very, very important, that we look at this as a comprehensive whole in order to address some of these issues and the disparities that you see within poor communities and communities of color.
Speaking of education, we have a great sponsor that's bringing college-level education to your tablets and TVs, and Rabia has actually used them. So let me pull in Rabia here for a second. And Rabia, what can you tell us about the great courses?
Thanks so much, Colin. Not only have I used them, I actually signed up for their latest service, which is amazing. It's called the Great Courses Plus. Now, I know all of our listeners are the kind of people who love to learn. Otherwise, you wouldn't be listening to something like Undisclosed. I'm also that kind of person. I love to read. I love to consume information. And the fact that this new video learning service can give you access to over 7,000 video lectures, unlimited, it's amazing. They're taught by top professors. And, you know, one I want to talk about today actually is called The Fundamentals of Photography. Now, believe it or not, back in the day, and I mean really back in the day, like high school, I was the school photographer and I was the yearbook photographer. I did some local sports photography, and I really thought that was going to be my profession. Unfortunately, it didn't work out. I also didn't ever become a pro, but I learned a lot when I took this course from the Great Courses. The Fundamentals of Photography is taught by professional photographer and National Geographic fellow Joel Sartori. And, you know, I learned a lot of great tips to take better pictures, like lighting, framing, perspectives. And I don't know if you've noticed, but if you follow me on social media and you check out my pictures of my beloved cat, Mr. Beans, you might notice that they're pretty good pictures. So you guys can learn a lot, whether it's about photography or about so many other subjects, history, cooking, technology, science, I mean, religion, it's all there. With the Great Courses Plus, you can watch as many different lectures as you want, anytime, anywhere. Now, I know you're going to love the Great Courses as much as I do. You're going to love the Great Courses Plus even more. So why don't you sign up today? Because as one of our listeners, you are immediately going to get 1 month free, and you can start watching as many lectures as you want. Make sure to check out the course that I watched, Fundamentals of Photography, and start your free trial today. You can sign up at thegreatcoursesplus.com/undisclosed. Again, that's thegreatcoursesplus.com/undisclosed. All right, Colin, I'm going to hand it back to you.
You know, both of you have focused a bit on community policing, and I wonder about community legislating in the sense that we're at a time in American politics where there's record dissatisfaction with the gridlock in Washington and how things aren't getting done. What do you two see as the best way for citizens to get involved in politics on the local level, the state level, the national level?
A final point to Jamie's anecdote. We both sat with a prisoner who was having lunch at that prison, and he was crying out for opportunities to learn, to get a trade or a skill that would allow him to go back and take care of his family. He had a couple of grandchildren he needed to take care of, and was excited maybe to learn about plumbing or being an electrician or finding a trade or skill that would allow him to be successful in the private sector. And so I think when it comes to education, you know, we've gotten so far away from vocational training in high schools or even middle school that gives students a pathway to opportunity. And so across the state here in South Carolina, I know a lot of schools now are looking at this and finding ways to give students technical skills. It's really important. In fact, employers like Boeing and BMW have a shortage of workers that have skills, and that's a concerning thing when it comes to the future. So, Colin, to answer your question about getting people involved, it's about being informed. And I think one of the challenges that we face is the talk radio and news media cycles. You know, the news is basically on TV, at least, made in 7-minute increments where people agreeing and liking each other, people turn the channel. And so these news channels have figured out that if we can get two people on TV who hate each other as much as possible, it makes for a great 7 minutes of TV, and we'll cut to commercial and we'll come back and do it again. And so you add that to the talk radio system where you have a paid professional class that simply exists to divide people in the effort to make money. Then you can see how we get to a point where people think that all the problems in the country are caused by the opposite political party, or in many cases of their own political party, because they've been told they should be divided so much by people. So we've got to find ways as political parties to communicate better. I think that the past few years, particularly in the U.S. Congress, that before John Boehner lost as Speaker, the House Republicans didn't communicate very well with the things that they passed. A few people know that just in the past session in Congress that actually, you know, Republicans have been promising limited government, and we've passed very few new laws in Congress and have held a line on discretionary spending and have actually chipped away some of the budget deficits. But you don't hear those things because it does not sell ratings, doesn't sell TV ads. We've got to find a way as a party to communicate better.
I totally agree with Matt, and I would say Democrats have some of the same criticisms. We have to, of our own party, I mean, we have to find a way to communicate better, find a way to connect with folks better. And I think that's part of that disconnection is what you're seeing playing out in the presidential race this year. This sort of disgruntled feeling that the parties are not addressing the issues that are most important to the people right now. And you have some, you know, some candidates who are going out tapping into some of that frustration and distrust that have sort of built up over the course of the past few years. And so, but I want to go back briefly to also the prisoner that Matt spoke about. One of the things that just sort of lingers with me is that he had been in the prison system for a long time, and he basically said one of the things that he was most concerned with, the young guys that are coming into the system today, and the fact that they don't have anything to do, and that they're not learning a skill, and that, you know, the takeaway for us was they need more programs within the systems. So again, keep those idle minds from being a devil's workshop. And so I think that's important, you know, teaching these young people, if you mess up, that you can come back into society and be a productive member. And here are some things that you should understand. Financial issues, like how to invest in the stock market, why having good credit is important. You know, all these things that we sort of take for granted. But if you grow up in a poor community where nobody has any of those positives, the only way that you're going to learn about them is if somebody teaches that stuff to you. And I think we need to take advantage of that opportunity to make sure that we're instilling young people and people who get caught into this, you know, system, what the right path forward is.
Yeah, and Jamie, I've been really honored to hear all of our listeners and the extent to which our podcast has sort of whetted the appetite of people engaging in the criminal justice system, maybe becoming lawyers, paralegals, et cetera. And what you speak to, I think, is a pretty big segment of the population that really just would have no idea how to become an attorney, which we've addressed. But I know you're working on a book that deals with the path to becoming involved in politics. And so for our younger listeners or people who might be interested in a career change and going into politics, what's some advice you might give them about how they can engage in the system that way?
Yeah, so I am currently working on a book right now called Climbing the Hill, How to Build a Career in Congress and Make a Difference, with another one of my Republican friends, Amos Sneed from Washington, D.C., basically giving folks an opportunity, you know, who want to be a part of the policymaking engine of this of the country, which is working on Capitol Hill, working in the House of Representatives and United States Senate. The one thing that I always tell young people when talking with them is the first thing you have to do, regardless of what field you want to be in, is you have to follow your passions. You have to figure out what is the thing that really gets me going. What is it that I really like doing it? What is it that I'm really passionate about? And once you figure that out, then you build a career or build some path to get to that point. And you figure out the careers where you can do those things that you're interested in. I was always interested in politics, and there's no better place to engage in politics and also to engage in policy, which is an important component of politics, than working on Capitol Hill. And so I started doing internships, and then those internships turned into a job in a congressman's office. That job then turned to opportunities to serve as executive director for the House Democrats and then to work in the Whip's office where I worked with the White House and all. So I've had a wonderful career, and then that led to me becoming chairman of a party. So again, I've been doing the things over the past 20 some odd years now, the things that I'm most passionate about, and I've enjoyed every minute of them. And the one thing that I know that sometimes young people get caught up, well, I want to do something that makes money. The thing that I've always learned, if you do something well, then people will eventually pay you for it. If you follow what you are passionate about, then odds are you're going to do it well. And so don't worry about the income and all that stuff. That will come. Focus on doing what's in your wheelhouse, working on issues that you feel passionate about.
Yeah, and Matt, I don't know whether this is specifically something that the Republicans introduced. It's been noted in the press as a bipartisan bill, but it's this new, it's really an overhaul of South Carolina's foster care system. And I think just last night they ratified the foster care normalcy bill. And looking at the sponsors, it looks like it's bipartisan. Can you tell us a bit about that measure and the extent to which it's bipartisan and why it's both a Republican and a Democratic issue?
Well, South Carolina has faced some challenges over the last few years with its foster care system, both in terms of the management of the actual agency that oversees the foster care system and with the sheer numbers of children who unfortunately need foster care. Fortunately, too, the low number of families who are qualified to foster. Ideally, foster children are placed back with their birth families. That is the ideal circumstance. But we need more foster parents in the interim. So the bill that was passed this week actually lowers, in a good way, some of the standards to foster. For example, previously there was a cap that was maybe unreasonably low on the number of children you could have in your household before you could foster or to prevent you from fostering. That cap's been raised a bit. I know of a number of families personally who have been lobbying for this for years who want to help more children but just simply can't because they have four or five kids of their own, maybe who are teens. They want to bring in a foster infant or foster young child to work with them, to help them in the hope that they'll go back to their birth family if their challenges there can be challenged. So I think it's a combination of that human element and also the element of that this system here in South Carolina needed some change and needed some positive momentum to go forward. And that's why we saw the bipartisan support for the bill this week.
Jamie, in summation, what is the message that you would send out to the people as we have this very contentious election that's going on in 2016? What do you think that the people out there can do, and what do you think should be done during this election cycle that might maybe change the views that people have in politics and the way that the elected officials work for the people of the country?
Yeah, you know, one of the things that our founding fathers always told us that was important is that the importance of educating ourselves and being an educated populace, being an educated electorate. It is so important. I know people are so busy because they have so much to do in their lives to take care of their kids and what have you. But it's so important that I think American citizens, regardless if you're a Democrat, Republican, or independent, that you go out and educate yourselves on the candidates, the issues that they stand for, their backgrounds, and what's in your best interest. And in the end of the day, it's also equally important that you go out and vote. Again, you know, I would prefer that folks vote for the Democratic Party, but ultimately, as an American, it's important that people just go out and vote and make sure that their voices are heard and exercised. Because if you don't, then you allow other people to make choices and decisions that impact you and impact the lives of the people that you care about. And so at the end of the day, you know, one thing that we all like to do is complain, but you don't have any right to complain if you don't participate. That is my admonition for everybody this election cycle and all election cycles, that it's important to just get yourself educated, know the issues, know the people and where they stand on those issues. And then in the end of the day, you need to make a decision that's in the best interest of you and your family.
So Matt, I'll give you the final word, basically the same question as we are in the middle of and approaching this contentious election cycle this year. What type of thoughts and advice do you have for both the politicians and the public as we enter into this very vigorous debate?
South Carolina has gone through some incredible trials of the past year. The shooting of an unarmed African-American male by a police officer in North Charleston, to the shootings in Charleston, the nine people shot at the AME church there, to the incredible floods we faced last fall. So I think South Carolina offers some lessons for the country. Particularly, everyone's favorite word is their own name. And with that name comes history or meaning or respect. Yet so many people get caught up in my history instead of our history. They almost worship their own history while telling everyone else to forget theirs. They say, you know, move on from that and live in the moment. And that event or that history, that person doesn't matter. So I think about our nation's motto, E Pluribus Unum, which is out of many, one. And that's the American spirit. We have to be a cohesive country. We're a great country. We've always been a great country because we're a melting pot of ideas, cultures, and beliefs. Who fought for that one vision of a country that gave opportunity that's greater for the next generation of that which lives now. And so I want our elected officials, no matter who they are this time next year, to carry that same spirit forward.
Jamie and Matt, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me today, and good luck as the election season progresses.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
So, can people like Jamie and Matt spearhead the bipartisan reform to our criminal justice system that's so sorely needed, or are any such reforms bound to fall prey to the partisan bickering we see in so many cases? This question was posed to Dean Strang, one of the attorneys for Stephen Avery of Making a Murderer, and here was his response. Actually, I really do think that a broad spectrum, cutting across both the Republican and the Democratic parties and other public office holders, are at least talking about the right issues now. Whether that's Rand Paul or Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton or Ted Cruz, you are hearing some interest in striking a new balance on individual liberty, on privacy. Maybe some rethinking of the liberty and privacy we've given up in the years after September 11th. Also, you're hearing some fiscal sense for the first time from major political parties and most candidates within them, on getting smart on punishment, and not ruining people's lives forever over minor drug offenses, and simply not any longer mindlessly incurring both the fiscal and the social costs of unreasonably long prison terms and mandatory minimum sentences that remove common sense from the sentencing process. You can hear more from Dean Strang when he's interviewed next week by Rabia, next time on Undisclosed.
Many thanks to Ramiro Marquez for our theme music and photography, to Christy Williams for our website, and to Baluki, who designed our logo. Audio production by Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media and the host of the podcast Crime Writers On. Our executive producer is Dennis Robinson. You can find us on Facebook and on Twitter. Our handle is UndisclosedPod. Make sure to tweet us your comments and questions using the hashtag Undisclosed.